This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
And welcome to Live and Learn. You're listening to What If Malaysia, an 8-episode mini-series where we explore what Malaysia could look like with specific progressive ideas, concepts and policies. I'm Dashran Johan, and previously on the show, we asked the question, what if Malaysia abolishes the death penalty? On today's show, we'll be exploring what if Malaysia ratified the 1951 Refugee Convention. But as always, I can't do this alone. So joining me on the show today is Katrina Jorin Maliomau, the Executive Director at Amnesty International Malaysia, as well as Aslam Abdul Jalil. He's a PhD candidate at the University of Queensland, and his area of research is refugee policy. Welcome to the show, guys. How are y'all doing?
I'm great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Katrina, perhaps you could start by explaining what exactly is the 1951 Refugee Convention. I mean, is it a very important convention? Is it legally binding? And I ask this because oftentimes when we try to hold the government of the day, in Malaysia, accountable for alleged treatment of refugees, the argument many make is that Malaysia isn't a signatory of the 1951 Refugee Convention, and so the government isn't obligated to do so and so.
So the 1951 Refugee Convention can be said as one of the, or perhaps the first international agreement that sort of sets out clearly who a refugee is, what are the responsibilities of governments to protect refugees. It's meant to be a collaborative response by governments, right? Because we have to understand that the nature of refugees is one that requires an international response. Within the convention, I think, you know, the question is it important? Yes, it is important because it lays out these tools that countries can use to respond to refugees, and also provides a definition. So Article 1 of the convention defines a refugee as someone who is outside their country of nationality. So there's an element here of having crossed a border, and they have a well-founded fear of persecution. And this well-founded fear of persecution comes because of their race, their religion, their nationality, their membership of a particular social group or political opinion. So five elements there. And they are unable to, or they cannot get protection of their home country, because their home country either will not protect them or cannot do so. And they cannot return to their home country because of that fear of persecution. Mm. So that sort of sets out the idea of who a refugee is. Now, the question that you had is, you know, on Malaysia and the Refugee Convention.
Yes.
So Malaysia is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, but that doesn't mean that Malaysia cannot do anything to protect refugees right now. So there are two sort of distinct things here that we have to think about. You know, firstly, international human rights law, the UN Convention on the Rights of Refugees, and also what any country can do right now to make sure that people within their jurisdiction are protected. And so is the convention important? Yes. Do you need the convention before you act? No, you can certainly do many things right now, as countries often do. Governments pass all kinds of laws, and they can certainly choose to protect refugees in their midst.
And what exactly is Malaysia's official position on refugees and refugee issues? Do we even have one? Because sometimes it does seem that, you know, from year to year, depending on which government is in power, the stance sort of changes. Is it a fluid sort of thing in Malaysia right now?
So Malaysia doesn't formally recognize who a refugee is. You know, there's no policy or legal framework to address the rights and protection needs of refugees. But, you know, you see in some ways and through which the government sort of accepts the idea of a refugee. So, for example, the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, exists in Malaysia through a memorandum of understanding. They register refugees, you know, after refugees go through quite a lengthy interview process. The government also has an agreement that there should be a 50% discount off foreigner rates at government hospitals for UNHCR cardholders. They say that they do not detain and deport refugees, although we know that that is not necessarily true. And so while the government on one hand refuses to specifically name refugees in their policies, there are these ways in which it tries to say, especially when pressed by the international community, that we don't persecute refugees. Now, the overarching lens through which refugees in this country are viewed is that of quote-unquote illegals or pati, which is both really hideous terms in sort of the legal system and also in the socio-political cultural imagination, right? Because here, when we talk about illegality, we're really referring to people's undocumented status, but illegality further sort of strips their rights and humanity. So that's the governing framework. You know, the Immigration Act and the fact that you don't have appropriate documents is what's used against refugees in Malaysia.
Now, Aslam, do we know why Malaysia isn't a part of the Refugee Convention?
Well, I've engaged with the policymakers throughout several years, actually. So the main concern is always a pull factor, because the government, the authorities believe that whenever we give some form of rights to refugees, more people will come. I don't deny, you know, in refugee movement, there's like some pull factors, you know, that perhaps affect their decision to go to a certain place. However, push factors are more significant, because no one would leave their homes, no one would leave their countries of origin without any like strong pressure or push factors that, you know, led them to do so. Yeah, it's true that Malaysia is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, and Malaysia does not recognize refugee status. However, Malaysia acknowledges the presence of refugees in Malaysia. This is through National Security Council Order Number 23, which classifies refugees as Parti Pemegang Kad UNHCR or UNHCR cardholder illegal immigrants. And also National Security Council Order Number 16 regarding refugees in Sabah. I would argue that, you know, Malaysia does not need to sign the Refugee Convention, but the most important thing is, you know, to have a proper policy in this country. And in fact, with the current existing legislative and administrative frameworks, Malaysia is able to provide protection to these refugees. So if you look at the Immigration Act, Section 55, and also Section 4 of the Passports Act, these sections actually give exemption powers to the minister to allow a certain group of people from being subjected to the laws. And we have actually done this before. And if you want to be more specific, under Regulation 11.10 of the Malaysian Immigration Regulations 1963, actually provides some form of documentation to certain group of people. So in the past, we have issued IMM13 cards to refugees from Southern Philippines, Moro refugees, to the Achnes refugees, currently the ongoing program to the Syrian refugees. So this is something that we have done, and it is also legal. It is already, you know, it exists in our legal system.
So you're saying that our country actually has a proper legal framework when it comes to refugee issues?
No, we don't have a proper legal framework. But, you know, we have, I mean, this is exercised under the exemption powers given to the minister. So Minister of Home Affairs can actually issue exemption order, for example, under the Federal Gazette, saying that certain group of people should be exempted from the strict immigration rules or Passports Act. And we've done that. So it is not something new.
How does it make it difficult for the Malaysian law, or does it even make it difficult, right, to distinguish between refugees and undocumented migrants? Is it important to have a clear distinction between them, Katrina?
I think that the distinction between a refugee and an undocumented migrant is necessary only for the understanding that refugees have heightened risks and particular protection needs, right? And I say this because I think that, you know, detention should never be used as a tool for immigration control, for example, because it's immensely harmful and it's traumatizing. no one should be deported willy-nilly, right? Sort of the international principle of non-refoulement is a customary international law, and it's binding on all states whether or not they've ratified the convention, and that includes Malaysia. It's important because there are also particular infrastructure needs that need to be set up, you know, to sort of receive and recognize and respond to the protection needs of refugees. It is also really important to understand that particular groups of people have particular needs. And when you don't set up a system to recognize those needs, then what you end up doing is furthering harm, putting people at really grave risk, setting it up that you may then end up deporting individuals who cannot be deported because they face real credible threats to their lives. Understanding that, you know, refugees have children, for example, you know, cannot be returned, and therefore they have to go to school. I mean, there's all these other things that come into place. And when we don't set up a system to see the needs of people, when we only couch groups of people under this framework of illegality, then what that does is that it invisibilizes what the rights are, and it perpetuates and fosters the harms and the violations of rights that can take place.
In addition to that, actually in 2005, the Attorney General's Chambers issued a circular saying that UNHCR card holders should not be prosecuted based on immigration offences. So that's recognition of, you know, the distinction between refugees and also undocumented migrants by the Malaysian government. However, in practice, many UNHCR card holders get arrested and also get extorted as well. So in Malaysia, since we do not have any asylum system, UNHCR is the only agency that conducts refugee status determination. So what happens in Malaysia is that, for example, undocumented persons gets arrested and they'll be put in detention centres. So UNHCR actually went to these detention centres to assess these people's claims. And if they were found to be refugees, you know, they would be issued refugee status by UNHCR. Unfortunately, since August 2019, UNHCR has been denied entry to detention centres. And therefore, that's why we could see, you know, asylum seekers and refugees, you know, being risk of deportation, and some of them already being deported by the Malaysian government.
This is what I'm still a little bit confused about, right? As Aslam brought up earlier, you know, Malaysia isn't exactly averse to helping refugees, right? I mean, historically speaking, despite not being a party to the Refugee Convention, Malaysia has actually provided protection for some categories of displaced persons, right? And this includes Filipino refugees, Cambodian, Vietnamese refugees, even Bosnian refugees, Indonesian refugees. And these, you know, since the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and even a lot of Myanmar refugees as well. So with that in mind, why is Malaysia reluctant to be a party to the convention?
So Malaysia's acceptance to its refugees is based on humanitarian exception. So in certain cases, you know, we accept refugees, but we do not want to take any responsibility, because if you have any law or if you sign any convention, you have the responsibility, and it is illegal for Malaysia not to fulfill its responsibilities to its refugees. So that is why humanitarian exception is, in the view of Malaysian state, is the best way, because we do not have the responsibility, but because of humanitarian grounds, we're helping these people. So that actually makes Malaysia look good in terms of, you know, its prestige. That's why I believe, you know, Malaysia will not sign the Refugee Convention, because if we sign, then, you know, we have to fulfill the obligations.
Katrina, just to add another layer to that question, right? It seems sometimes that Malaysia's actions towards the refugees have been rather contradictory, right? I mean, even though the Malaysian government has in the past acknowledged the Rohingya situation and has even vowed not to deport the Rohingya refugees, they have also at the same time been consistently preventing them from entering the Malaysian waters. Why is there this sort of contradiction going on?
First, I think sort of these are like excellent questions to pose to the Malaysian government. And I don't mean this facetiously. I think it actually is really important that the government of Malaysia answer the people of Malaysia, answer the international community that we belong to. So why? Why do we not provide safety to people who need it? Or why do we only do it sometimes when pressed or when we think, I don't know. Why do we spend so much resources, right? Turning away boats of people fleeing terror. Why do we inflict sort of the unimaginable trauma of detention on people because of their immigration status? Why do we both deny any kind of social welfare to refugees and deny them their right to work? Why do we refuse to be part of the international community of countries that say we will play our part to protect people who have been persecuted? Is it humanitarian to create a climate where people live in fear and uncertainty? Is it humanitarian for people to be denied the right to work? What do we mean by humanitarian?
Moreover, the acceptance of refugees is based on cultural and religious affinity, because throughout history, we could see that, you know, Malaysian state actually favors Muslim refugees. So as we can see, you know, the Moro refugees, most of them were actually Muslims, and they were absorbed into the local community in Sabah. And some of them got permanent residency, some of them got IMM13 cards, some of them got citizenship. In 1987, UNHCR actually decided, you know, to cease its operations in Sabah because these refugees, you know, already achieved the standard of living far with the locals. And that's why UNHCR is now just, you know, operating in Peninsula Malaysia.
Right.
Also, when the Indo-Chinese boat people actually came, around 250,000 of them, initially, Malaysia was reluctant to accept them into Malaysia in light of 1969 racial riots. And that's why, you know, Malaysia initially, you know, was reluctant. But because of a true comprehensive plan of action between Malaysia and third countries with UNHCR as well, so finally we allowed them, you know, to stay here temporarily. But, you know, it wasn't really a big issue because, you know, these 250,000 refugees who were mainly ethnic Chinese actually were resettled to third countries. In terms of Rohingya, for example, as we could see, you know, the politicians actually used the issue, you know, to champion Muslim rights or, you know, the Muslim Ummah sentiment. However, it's only a rhetoric in terms of policy implementation. We don't see that being translated because, you know, Rohingya refugees in Malaysia are still being denied access to basic rights.
All right, on that note, we do need to go for a very quick break. After a break, we'll be exploring what Malaysia could look like if the 1951 Refugee Convention is ratified, or at least if we had, you know, proper legal frameworks when it comes to refugee and refugee issues. So we'll be back with more on What If Malaysia, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to What If Malaysia, an 8-episode miniseries where we examine what Malaysia could look like with certain progressive ideas, concepts and policies. I'm Darshan Johan, and with me on the show today is Katrina Jorin Maliamau, the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia, as well as Aslam Abdul Jalil, a PhD candidate at the University of Queensland, whose area of research and passion is refugee policy. And we are exploring what if Malaysia ratified the 1951 Refugee Convention. Now, Katrina, one thing we haven't touched on is the lack of legal framework. How does it actually affect the lives of refugees when they arrive at our shores, or when they are attempting to reach Malaysian shores, for example? How does it affect them?
Yeah, I think that it's so important that we contextualize the human person in all of these discussions, right? And so sometimes in sort of the legalese of it, the actual living human body can be lost. And so thank you for asking that question. I think when I talked earlier about this framework of illegality that is used to frame refugees in Malaysia, illegality is sort of seen by the government as something that gives a quote-unquote permission to strip people of their rights and their dignity and their humanity. It's a license to say that you do not belong, that you do not exist, that you should not exist. And also we see it as a tool to sort of absolve those who perpetuate harm of any responsibility. And I think, you know, of course, being undocumented is an administrative matter. It's one of paperwork. But in Malaysia, it defines your entire being, you know. And it appears that the Immigration Act here is taken to be supreme, right? So even though we have the Child Rights Convention, we have labor laws, we have the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, we have all of these mechanisms in place to address violence. I mean, despite all of that, sort of the Immigration Act is under which refugees are viewed and responded to. And so what does this mean, right? What does it mean when we say that, you know, you're subjected to arrest and detention, that you're denied labor protection, that you're denied the access to education? Thinking about sort of the decade plus that I have worked with and alongside refugees, you know, this is the word that comes up over and over and over again is one of fear. You know, that kind of terror that sort of trembles within you, right? when you just exist, when you try to find ways to hide yourself and your child as you walk down the street, when the image of somebody in enforcement outfit makes you shake, when your baby is growing inside of you, but you don't go to the hospital, you don't go for screenings, and you wait and you wait and you wait, even if something feels wrong, because you're too afraid that if you go, you might be arrested on the way to the hospital or at the hospital, or that the fees are too high, and that you have to choose here between, you know, feeding yourself and your family or paying rent or going to seek medical treatment. You know, it's about children who are growing up learning in these really piecemeal ways, and that you're not sure that you can have even dreams, because what does your future hold when there's so much uncertainty around you? Or when there's a certification from a learning center that you went to in absence of a school, but that's not going to be recognized. You know, I think it's this fear of being deported, of being separated from your loved ones, from your community. And when you take whatever job you can get, right? Because, and for whatever salary that your employer chooses to you, regardless of your skill or your ambitions, because you're told you can't work legally. And if you're exploited, well, you shouldn't have been working anyway. I think, I mean, these are just some examples of really what we mean when we say there isn't a policy, when it's ad hoc, when it sets up discrimination and violence.
That sounds absolutely terrifying. And I'm immediately reminded of, you know, I was speaking to a refugee on another show about a couple of weeks back. And, you know, he said that the life of a refugee is the worst ever. It's the worst life. There's just so much of challenges, and just listening to you and break them down and listening to a lot of the stories, it's really terrifying. It's really heartbreaking. Aslam, Germany is a country which is widely known as the country that takes in, one of the most amount of refugees and adopts one of the most welcoming approaches in its migrant policy compared to other European countries. This is since the start of the refugee crisis back in 2015. It has been reported that the influx of refugees has helped to boost the German economy as the refugees are getting more integrated into the labor force. Can you explain how Germany has benefited economically from providing the refugees asylum?
Well, basically, I guess by having refugees and also migrants, actually, it will create a win-win situation for both host society as well as refugee and migrant community, because, you know, refugees, they come with skills and expertise which can be utilized by the country that is hosting them. I would like to point out a very interesting fact, in Germany. So back in 2015, Angela Merkel actually was criticized by some Germans and That's also right. praised by some Germans as well, for international community for letting in almost 1 million refugees into the country. And because of that, there's a rise of far-right alternative party because, you know, people were opposing this policy. Interestingly, because of COVID-19, they actually needed doctors. And currently, there are 14,000 Syrian doctors waiting for their qualifications to be approved. And basically, you know, in Saxony, where this AfD, basically Saxony is the stronghold of AfD, actually requires these refugees, you know, to contribute back to the society. So this is an example of how, you know, refugees who were being, I mean, people opposed to their, you know, arrival, but, you know, now these refugees are able to contribute back to the society. And when we talk about refugee crisis, actually it is not a crisis. I guess, you know, we have to handle it properly. As Katrina mentioned earlier, 85% of the total refugee population in the world actually is hosted in developing countries like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Pakistan, Turkey. And, you know, these countries have been hosting, and also Pakistan, have been hosting millions of refugees for years, despite of, you know, lack of resources and infrastructure and so on. But, you know, they've done their best. So I guess it is a collaborative effort between, you know, all nations around the world to actually, you know, empower refugees and give them opportunities.
Katrina, I want to get your take on this because as Aslam mentioned, this is something you brought up right before we started recording, actually, when we were just having a conversation about this topic. You had something very interesting to say about the way European media has sort of framed themselves as these bigger saviors when it comes to refugees and whatnot. But you have an interesting take on that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, picking up on what Aslam said also, that really the majority of the world's refugees are in Asia and in Africa. And yet somehow this, it's couched in the media, politically, in our sort of global imagination, that the West, quote unquote, or Europe has a refugee crisis. But actually, you know, as Aslam said, we don't have a refugee, quote unquote, crisis. We have a crisis maybe of response. So you see where countries that really have immense resources who should be stepping up even more to sort of address the needs of people who are facing persecution, are pushing back and building greater barriers, right, and borders. And so firstly, I think, you know, let's just challenge that premise that is a refugee crisis in Europe. Secondly, sort of to the question about the economic benefits, you know, will it be economically beneficial? Will it be a drain on the economy? I mean, firstly, I think, you know, refugees are already participating in the economy. You know, they work, they spend money, they sell things, they pay sales tax. All of that is already happening. And the question is, are we counting them though? But secondly, and I think more importantly, I am really uncomfortable with the premise that the lives and rights and dignity of people should be protected because there's good economic motive for it. I think, you know, if we think about the economy as a system that is sort of meant to create the production and the trade of goods and services alone, then what we cease to see is the human persons within it. So who is the economy meant to serve? It's meant to serve us. And if we make the economy and the economy needs to serve our needs, then if we think of it that way, human beings at a fundamental level cannot be a drain on the economy. You know, we have to create an economy for those among us who have the least. If their rights are met, if their needs are fulfilled, then that economy works for all of us. And I think, I mean, maybe this sort of like a bigger discussion to have, but we like to pit sometimes, you know, foreigners against Malaysians, refugees against undocumented migrants. But really what we're saying is that if you understand that human rights at a fundamental level belong to all of us, then we have to make sure that those rights are protected. And if the people who have the least, who are the most marginalized, if their needs are met, then you can only imagine how that grows for the rest of us. Because then no one is left out, right? Mm-hmm. And so this question of, you know, what do they bring to the table? You cannot ask that question when it comes to whether people should be allowed to survive or not. Imagine if we thought about that for Malaysians. Should we let someone die because they don't have any beneficial impact for our economy? Because they don't have particular skills that are worthy in this moment in time? I mean, at a very basic level, I think this is a question of what our morals are and our values are. And from there, you know, we think about how do we want to organize ourselves? Because really there is enough. There's more than enough for all of us. It's a question of who is getting it and how.
So regarding Syrian refugees, so in 2015, actually Malaysia launched a Syrian Migrants Temporary Relocation Program, which targets semi and high-skilled Syrians. So this program is undergoing. to shelter 3,000 Syrian refugees in Malaysia. So they are issued with IMM13 card. So with IMM13 card, they are able to live here legally and they're able to work legally and also get medical treatment as well as education. The problem is, this program is not implemented very well because, as I mentioned earlier about what's happening in Germany, at least, there's access for these educated people to, contribute back. Not just educated people, I mean anyone, they can contribute back to the society. However, in Malaysia, I've met, several Syrian refugees under this program. They are very highly educated, engineers, but because there's no proper channel, they are unable to, contribute their skills to Malaysia, despite Malaysia is having a brain drain situation, right? So these highly educated Syrians, they end up doing odd jobs. They end up being exploited as well because of, lack of support, under this program. So that is something that we need to fix. The intention is great to help, mitigate the Syrian issue. However, the implementation is poor and, we need improvement.
Katrina, I want to dig deeper into what you brought up earlier because I absolutely agree on a personal level, right, that you need not even talk about the economy when we are talking about human rights. We are talking about people's lives here. However, when it comes to talking to the average Malaysian, right, a lot of people have this idea that refugees, they are going to come and they're going to steal our jobs and they're going to use up our resources, right? This is something that a lot of people have on their minds. So what would you say to people who have this fear?
Firstly, I think that, no one is sort of stealing jobs, right? So if you have situations where there are people who are being offered jobs and at very low wages, and they are compelled to take that because of desperation, that is a situation not of the workers who are exploited, but of the employers and the businesses and the systems that set that up. And so if you have a situation where migrant rights are exploited, migrant workers are exploited, then you also set up precarity for Malaysian workers, And so, again, this idea of if we have to sort of hoard the rights for ourselves, all that does is that it diminishes rights for all of us, because you're giving permission to the state to say that, okay, you don't have to protect the rights of X, Y, and Z. And if you don't protect them now for migrants, really, what leg do we have to stand on to say that they should be protected for anyone else? Secondly, I think that, what is it that we, it's a useful sort of tool, I think, to ramp up our anti-migrant sentiments, to think about people as being a drain on resources. But really, what are we imagining that people need, I think if you speak to most refugees, really what people want is kind of just to be left alone, They want to be able to live in peace, have a job, enjoy their job or not, have a family, just live in safety and in dignity, and participate in sort of this idea of society and community. Yes, there might be people who need some healthcare needs, just like everybody else. Yes, you may have to do something to sort of set up reception for people who are arriving on boats. Sure. But we're already spending so much money harming people through, by fortifying our borders, by detaining people, and so the immense resources go into marginalization and denial of rights. What if we flipped that around and said, what we're going to do instead is think about how we facilitate people's access to their basic needs and to allow them to really just live in dignity and in safety. I think it's, if we can ask that question for others, we can ask that question also then for ourselves, because again, I don't want us to think about this as just a refugee issue or a migrant issue at a very fundamental level. It's about how do we think people, what are the rights that people deserve, and what are our values here?
Another concern, right, when we're speaking of the fears that people might have is also crime rates, right? Because if we go back to the polarized political debate in Germany, some of the arguments that people made is that the influx of refugees, it's going to then, the crime rate in the country is then going to skyrocket. What are your thoughts on this?
Unfortunately, it's because of xenophobic and, you know, racist sentiment that actually causes, you know, that perception. Because, you know, historically, refugees and migrants have been become scapegoats of whatever problems that we have in the country. So, you know, we look what happened in the US with Donald Trump, for example, or Fraser Anning in Australia. So many Malaysians actually condemn them for being racist and xenophobic. While at the same time, you know, we have the perception, similar perception towards refugees and migrants.
The irony.
Yeah. But if you look at the statistics, for example, you know, less than 1% of crimes actually committed by foreigners. And by foreigners, you know, it could mean refugees, migrants, students, tourists, and so on and so on. I actually got, you know, the crime records from PDRM for UNHCR card holders since 2016 until 2020. And apparently, you know, every year, the numbers actually showed, you know, less than 300, you know, crimes committed by UNHCR card holders. You compare that small number with the total number of crimes committed in the country, then you can see the proportion. You know, it's not that big. It's just tiny, you know, proportion, just like what happened in Germany, for example. So, you know, the fear was out of proportion in Germany and also in Malaysia. And when you talk about economy, right, let's talk about, you know, numbers. So in a report by IDEAS back in 2019 or 2018, so actually they found out that if refugees are allowed to work legally in the country, they could contribute more than 3 billion ringgit by 2024 and also 50 million ringgit tax revenue each year, as well as creating jobs for Malaysians between 2,500 to 4,000 jobs for Malaysians if they are allowed to work. But if you want to talk about economy, these are, you know, the contributions that refugees, you know, have been, you know, making in the country and also, you know, potentially you know, contribute to our country. And I also had the privilege to actually, you know, be part of the discussion with the policymakers with regards to the right to work for refugees in Malaysia with the former minister and also the current minister. So basically, you know, Malaysia is concerned about, you know, Malaysia's trafficking in persons report, record actually by the US government, because somehow if you do badly in this report, there'll be some implications in terms of trade and so on. And we have seen this happened with, you know, the foreign workers issue. Even though, you know, the issues that we have recently involved foreign workers, I could attest that refugees actually face similar or even worse exploitation than the foreign workers. Because, you know, they don't have legal right to work. And this is also a major factor that contributed to our poor performance in trafficking in persons report record every year by the US State Department. And, you know, it's great that now, you know, the government is paying attention on forced labor issues, for example, by passing these anti-trafficking laws back in 2007. And also now, you know, seems like, you know, trying its best to implement these laws. And in terms of, you know, the right to work for refugees as well, you know, the government back in 2017 piloted a project, a pilot project for Rohingya refugees working at Sime Darby and Gardenia Bakeries. Unfortunately, the Sime Darby project failed, but Gardenia Bakeries, it is ongoing. But the thing is, you know, when people say, you know, Malaysia is not a signatory country and therefore we cannot do anything, you know, I really, you know, I think that's true. That's absolutely not true, because we've done this. And, you know, I visited Gardenia workers, Rohingya workers who have UNHCR card holders. And once they are part of this pilot project, they simply got a work permit by the immigration department.
Right.
In this country. And of course, you know, once they become a regularized worker, a formal worker, they are protected under the laws. You know, I met this guy, his name is Harun, a Rohingya worker. So he actually told me his experience before joining Gardenia program, you know, as informal worker, when, you know, he had no protection whatsoever. When he got into accident, he had to, you know, borrow a huge sum of money to get a treatment and so on. And, you know, his experience working with Gardenia, when he got sick, you know, everything was covered because he's a formal worker. So this is something that, you know, that can be done and has been done. So it is not something that, you know, we should sign the Refugee Convention, we should pass a new law, we should amend the law. There's nothing like that. So it is something that, you know, we can do under the current and existing legislative and administrative framework.
Now, let's also talk about how, you know, either ratifying the Refugee Convention or having a proper, well-defined legal framework can also benefit the refugees themselves. Aslam, how does having a proper legal framework help improve their quality of life?
Again, I want to stress this. There's no need for Malaysia to ratify the Refugee Convention. And practically speaking, Malaysia will not do so. And even if Malaysia ratifies the Refugee Convention, the most important thing is to have, you know, proper policy. That is the most important thing. You know, having a proper policy is the first thing, is the priority. Ideally, you know, if Malaysia signs a Refugee Convention, that's great, but that's not the priority. Having a policy which addresses four issues is the most important thing. Firstly, documentation. So, you know, we need to, there should be a clear communication between the authorities and UNHCR, you know, in terms of, you know, who gets registered and, you know, I mean, they shouldn't be arrested and so on and so forth. Employment, they should have the right to work legally. And when we say that, you know, they should be allowed to work, it doesn't mean that the government has the obligation to find work for them or jobs for them. That's not the case. Let the markets work. That's how it has been, you know. Just allow them to work. Employers, you know, are not scared of employing refugees because they know it is legal and refugees can, you know, seek justice if they are being exploited. Education, you know, support their learning centers. I know maybe it's not possible to allow refugees to attend local schools with Malaysians, unfortunately. However, you know, we should support their learning centers and, you know, provide some form of education. And of course, lastly, healthcare. You know, the healthcare cost should be more affordable. Right now, without proper employment, without the right to work, they are unable, you know, to earn a stable income, and therefore they cannot send their children to learning centers. And when they are sick, you know, they refuse to seek treatment because they have no money. So this is the most important thing, a policy that addresses documentation, employment, education, and healthcare.
Katrina?
We are past sort of this conversations about what ought to be done when. It is now. The longer we wait, we have generations of people that really have gone through the cycle of waiting for some kind of relief. I'll tell you really quickly the story of Noor, a Rohingya refugee who came to Malaysia as a child. She was a grandmother, and she told me that she feels like the Rohingya footballs were being kicked from one country to the other. She said that when she came first as a child, she had a dream for herself, which quickly died. Then she dreamt for her children. And she said now she's too afraid to even hold a dream for her grandchildren.
Oh, no.
We cannot be a country that denies people, stops people from even dreaming a generation ahead that something will be better.
All right. Katrina, Aslam brought up earlier that he does not see Malaysia ratifying the UN Refugee Convention. What are your thoughts? Do you think it might happen? Does it actually matter? Or like Aslam said, you know, yeah, if they sign it, great. If they don't, whatever, we can just put that aside, focus on our own policies here.
I think that we very urgently need domestic policies in place. Now, you don't need domestic policies before you ratify any convention, right? In fact, the ratification of the convention will sort of give you the tools and the ingredients to develop a robust policy. But I think given the trajectory that we're on, where we're really having arguments about whether or not you should deport people back to a country where they'll be persecuted, it doesn't look like the current government is interested in ratifying the convention, or even if they did, will they fulfill it or not? What I do know, though, is the Malaysian government is right now vying for a seat in the Human Rights Council. So it's quite fascinating to think about how you want to sit on the Human Rights Council while at the same time continue to discriminate and exclude people who are in need of assistance and people who gravely need it. Whether we're ready for it or not is a separate question. I think we have everything we need to do in order to make this happen. It's about political will. I think that you have to be bold in sort of your imagination for what's possible. I don't think we should be trying to compromise here and ask for the bare minimum. I think we need to set out goals for a country that can have a robust climate where people's rights and lives are protected and dignity uplifted. I think that this hope needs to be something that Malaysians have to feel and believe and practice. I think that our disinterest or cynicism or apathy gives the government a way out to not act. And it also allows the hateful voices, the xenophobic and anti-migrant and anti-racist sentiments to occupy all our spaces. So I think, yes, absolutely, the government has to do something now, but also the Malaysian public need to step up. You know, if we have to say that we want a country that celebrates people's lives and dignity, and I think we can do it, and we just need to be bold in trying to do so.
Why I don't see Malaysia signing the Refugee Convention anytime soon? Because of the recent issue. We see, you know, Malaysia withdrew from Rome Statute and Malaysia cancelled to ratify ICERD. So, you know, that's enough to show that, you know, there's no possibility of Malaysia signing the Refugee Convention anytime soon. Plus, you know, we are signatories to this to the CEDAW Convention, Convention on Women, Convention on Child, CRC, and CRPD, Convention on People with Disabilities. So we can use, you know, the existing instruments to push for, you know, better treatment for refugees in Malaysia and also migrants. And right now, you know, we are serious in achieving SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals agenda. And in fact, you know, SDGs basically now becomes, you know, the umbrella of whatever policy, you know, that is being formulated in Malaysia. So SDGs, you know, the mantra is no one is left behind. So no one, no human being should be left behind, regardless of their immigration status and so on. So we can use the existing, you know, frameworks to push for better rights for refugees and migrants in Malaysia. Because actually, you know, I've engaged with, you know, policymakers in this country. So one officer from Ministry of Foreign Affairs mentioned that, you know, the signatory countries, for example, Australia, even though no signing the Refugee Convention, but, you know, Australia imprisons refugees and basically, you know, breaches Refugee Convention. And that's why Malaysia, we know we don't sign, but we help them based on humanitarian grounds. But basically, it's giving an excuse. So in this matter, you know, signatory countries must also, you know, set good examples so that, you know, other countries will also, you know, give more rights to refugees. And basically, we need more collaboration between, you know, different countries and different parties.
All right. On that note, Azlam, Katrina, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
I've been speaking with Katrina Joreen Maliamau, the Executive Director at Amnesty International Malaysia, as well as Azlam Abdul Jalil, a PhD candidate at the University of Queensland, whose area of research is refugee policy. And they were exploring the question, what if Malaysia ratified the 1951 Refugee Convention? So if you missed any part of this conversation or any previous episodes of the series, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or you can even subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. You just have to search BFM Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Dashran Johan, and you've been listening to What If Malaysia on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.